where it was either too frigid or too hot. What Jack didn't like here were the sounds. Folks during their last days of life did not make pleasant noises, coughs, gagging, painful cries, but mostly it was the moaning. It never ceased. Then there was the squeak of the gurney wheels as the body of someone who had passed was taken away. The room freshened up for the next terminal case on the waiting list. Most patients here were elderly, yet Jack wasn't the youngest person. There was a boy with final stage leukemia two doors down. When Jack was being wheeled to his room, he'd seen the little body in the bed. Hairless head, vacant eyes, tubes all over him, barely breathing, just waiting for it to be over. His family would come every day. His mother was often here all the time. They would put on happy expressions when they were with him, and then start bawling as soon as they left his side. Jack had witnessed this as they passed his doorway, all hunched over, weeping into their cupped hands. They were just waiting, too, for it to be over, and at the same time, dreading when it would be. Jack reached under his pillow and pulled out the calendar. January 11th. He crossed it off. He had been here for 5 days. The average length of stay here, he'd heard, was 3 weeks. Without Lizzie, it would be 3 weeks too long. He again reached under his pillow and pulled out the 6 now crumpled envelopes with his letters to Lizzie inside them. He'd had Sammy bring them here from the house before it was listed for sale. He held them in his hands. The paper was splotched with his tears because he pulled them out and wept over them several times a day. What else did he have to do with his time? These letters now constituted a weight around his heart for a simple reason. Lizzie would never read them, never know what he was feeling in his last days of life. At the same time, it was the only thing allowing him to die with peace, with a measure of dignity. He put the letters away and just lay there, listening for the squeaks of the final gurney ride for another patient. They came with alarming regularity. Soon, he knew it would be his body on that stretcher. He turned his head when the kids came in, followed by Fred. He was surprised to see Cecilia stroll in with her walker and portable oxygen tank resting in a burgundy sling. It was hard for her to go outside in the cold weather, yet she had done so for Jack. Jackie immediately climbed up on his dad's lap, while Corey sat on the bed. Arms folded defiantly over her chest, Mickey stood by the door, as far away from everyone as she could be. She had on faded jeans with the knees torn out, heavy boots, a sleeveless unzipped parka, and a black long-sleeved t-shirt that said, "Remember Darfur." Her hair was now orange. The color contrasted sharply with the dark circles under her eyes. Corey had been saying something that only now Jack focused on. His son said, "But Dad, you'll be here and we'll be way out there."
"That's the way Dad apparently wants it,"
said Mickey sharply. Jack turned to look at her. Father's and daughter's gazes locked until she finally looked away, with an eye roll tacked on. Corey moved closer to him. "Look, I think the best thing we can do, Dad, is stay here with you. It just makes sense." Jackie, who was struggling with potty training, slid to the side of the bed and got down holding his privates.
"Gramps,"
said Mickey,
"Jackie has to go, and I'm not taking him this time."
Fred saw what Jackie was doing and scuttled him off to the bathroom down the hall. As soon as he was gone, Jack said, "You have to go, Cor." He didn't look at Mickey when he added, "You all do."
"But we won't be together, Dad," said Corey. "We'll never see each other."
Cecilia, who'd been listening to all this, quietly spoke up.
"I give you my word, Corey, that you will see your brother and sister early and often."
Mickey came forward. Her sullen look was gone, replaced with a defiant one.
Okay, but what about Dad? He just stays here alone? That's not fair.
Jack said, I'll be with you. And your mom will too, in spirit, he added a little lamely.
Mom is dead. She can't be with anyone,
snapped Mickey.
Mickey,
said Cecilia reproachfully.
That's not necessary.
Well, it's true. We don't need to be lied to. It's bad enough that I have to go and live with them in Arizona.
Tears filled Corey's eyes, and he started to sob quietly. Jack pulled him closer. Jackie and Fred came back in, and the visit lasted another half hour. Cecilia was the last to leave. She looked back at Jack.
You'll never be alone, Jack. We all carry each other in our hearts.
Those words were nice and heartfelt, he knew. But Jack Armstrong had never felt so alone as he did right now. He had a question, though.
Cecilia.
She turned back, perhaps surprised by the sudden urgency in his voice.
Yes, Jack?
Jack gathered his breath and said,
Lizzie told me she wanted to take the kids to the palace next summer.
Cecilia moved closer to him.
She told you that. The palace? My God, after all this time.
I know, but maybe the kids could go there sometime.
Cecilia gripped his hand.
I'll see to it, Jack. I promise.
Chapter 9. They all came in to visit Jack for the last time. They would be flying out later that day to their new homes. Bonnie was there, as was Fred. Corey and Jackie crowded around their father, hugging, kissing, and talking all at once to him. Jack was lying in bed, dressed in a fresh gown. His face and body were gaunt. The machines keeping him comfortable until he passed were going full blast. He looked at each of his kids for what he knew would be the final time. He'd already instructed Bonnie to have him cremated.
No funeral, he'd told her. I'm not putting the kids through that again.
I'll call you as soon as I get there, Dad, said Corey, who wouldn't look away from his father.
Me too,
chimed in Jackie. Jack took several deep breaths as he prepared to do what had to be done. His kids would be gone forever in a few minutes, and he was determined to make these last moments as memorable and happy as possible.
Got something for you, said Jack.
He'd had Sammy bring the three boxes to him. He slowly took them from the cabinet next to his bed and handed one to Corey and one to Jackie. He held the last one and gazed at Mickey.
For you.
What is it?
She asked, trying to seem disinterested, though he could tell her curiosity was piqued.
Come see.
She sighed, strolled over, and took the box from her father.
Open them, said Jack.
Corey and Jackie opened the boxes and looked down at the piece of metal with the purple ribbon attached. Mickey's was different. Fred said to her,
That's a bronze star. That's for heroism in combat. Your dad was a real hero. The other one's a purple heart's for being, well, hurt in battle. He finished, looking awkwardly at Corey and Jackie.
Jack said,
Open the box and think of me. Always be with you that way.
Even Bonnie seemed genuinely moved by this gesture, and she dabbed at her eyes with a tissue. But Jack wasn't looking at her. He was watching his daughter. She touched the metal carefully, and her mouth started to tremble. When she looked up and saw her dad watching her, she closed the box and quickly stuck it in her bag. Cecilia was the last to leave. She sat next to him and patted his hand with her wrinkled one.
How do you feel, Jack, really?
About dying or saying goodbye to my kids for the last time?
he said weakly.
I mean, do you feel like you want to let go?
Jack turned to face her, the confusion and even anger seeping into his features was met by a radiant calm in hers.
I'm in hospice, see? I'm dead.
Not yet, you're not.
Jack looked away, sucked down a tortured breath.
Matter of time. Hours.
Do you want to let go?
She asked again.
Yes, I do.
Okay, honey. Okay.
After Cecilia left, Jack lay there in the bed. His last ties to his family had been severed. It was over. He didn't need to pull out the calendar. There would be no more dates to cross off. His hand moved to the call button. It was time now. He had prearranged this with the doctor. The machines keeping him alive would be turned off. He was done. It was time to go. All he wanted now was to see Lizzie. He conjured her face up in his mind's eye.
It's time, Lizzie, he said. It's time.
The sense of relief was palpable. However, his hand moved away from the button when Mickey came back into the room and held up the medal.
I just wanted to say that this was pretty cool.
Father and daughter gazed awkwardly at each other, as though they were two long-lost friends, reunited by chance. There was something in her eyes that Jack had not seen there for a long time.
Mickey?
He said, his voice cracking. She ran across the room and hugged him. Her breath burned against his cold neck, warming him, sending packets of energy of strength to all corners of his body. He squeezed back, as hard as his depleted energy would allow. She said,
I love you so much. So much.
Her body shook with the pain, the trauma of a child soon to be orphaned. When she stood, Mickey kept her gaze away from him. When she spoke, her voice was husky.
Goodbye, Daddy.
She turned and rushed from the room.
Goodbye, Michelle.
Jack mumbled to the empty room. Chapter 10. Jack lay there for hours until day evaporated to night. The clock ticked and he didn't move. His breathing was steady, buoyed by the machine that replenished his lungs, keeping him alive. Something was burning in his chest that he could not exactly identify or even precisely locate. His thoughts were focused on his last embrace with his daughter, her unspoken plea for him not to leave her. With the end of his life, with his last breath, the Armstrong children would be without parents. His finger had hovered over the nurse's call button all day, ready to summon the doctor, to let it be over. But he never pushed it. As the clock ticked, the burn in Jack's chest continued to grow. It wasn't painful. Indeed, it warmed his throat, his arms, his legs, his feet, his hands. His eyes became teary and then dried, became teary and then dried again. Sobs came and went. And still his mind focused only on his daughter, that last embrace, that last silent plea. The nurses came and went. He was fed with liquid, shot like a bullet into his body. The clock ticked. The air continued to pour into him. At precisely midnight, Jack started feeling odd. His lungs were straining, as they had been when Jackie had pulled the line out of the converter at home. This might be it, Jack thought, button or no button. Not even the machines could keep him alive any longer. He had wondered what the moment would actually feel like. Wedged in a mass of burning metal in a rack after being blown up in his Humvee, he had wondered that too. Whether his last moments on Earth would be thousands of miles away from Lizzie and his kids, what it would feel like, what would be waiting for him. Who would not be scared, terrified even? The last journey, the one everyone took alone, without the comfort of a companion,
And unless one had faith, without the reassurance that something awaited him at the end. He took another deep breath, and then another. His lungs were definitely weakening. He could not drive enough oxygen into them to sustain life. He reached up and fiddled with the line in his nose. That's when he realized what the problem was. There was no airflow. He clicked on the bed light and turned to the wall. There was the problem. The line had come loose from the wall juncture. The pressure cuff had not come off, however, or he would have heard the air escaping into the room. He was about to press the call button, but decided to see if he could push the line back in himself. That's when it struck him. How long have I been breathing on my own? He glanced at the vitals monitor. The alarm hadn't gone off, though it should have. But as he gazed at the oxygen levels, he realized why the buzzer hadn't sounded. His oxygen levels hadn't dropped. How was that possible? He managed to push the line back in and took several deep breaths. Then he pulled the line out of his nose and breathed on his own for as long as he could. 10 minutes later, his lungs started to labor. Then he put the line back in. What the hell is going on? Over the next 2 hours, he kept pulling the line out and breathing on his own until he was up to 15 minutes. His lungs normally felt like sacks of wet cement. Now they felt halfway normal. At 3 a.m., he sat up in bed and then did the unthinkable. He released the side rail and swung around so his feet dangled over the sides of the bed. He inched forward until his toes touched the cold tile floor. Every part of him straining with the effort, little by little, Jack pushed himself up until most of his weight was supported by his legs. He could hold himself up for only a few seconds before collapsing back onto the sheets. Panting with the exertion, pain searing his weakened lungs, he repeated the movement twice more. Every muscle in his body was spasming from the strain. Yet as the sweat cooled on his forehead, Jack smiled, for good reason. He had just stood on his own power for the first time in months. The next morning, after the hospice nurse had come through on her rounds, he edged to the side of the bed again, and his toes touched the floor. But then his hands slipped on the bed covers, and he crumpled to the floor. At first he panicked, his hand clawing for the call button, which was well out of reach. Then he calmed. The same methodical, practical nature that had carried him safely through Iraq and Afghanistan came back to him. He grabbed the edge of the bed, tightened his grip, and pulled. His emaciated body slipped, slithered, and jerked until he was fully back on the bed. He lay there in quiet triumph, hard-earned sweat staining his hospice gown. That night he half walked and half crawled to the bathroom and looked at himself in the mirror for the first time in months. It was not a pretty sight. He looked 84 instead of 34. A sense of hopelessness settled over him. He was fooling himself. But as he continued to gaze in the mirror, a familiar voice sounded in his head.
You can do this, Jack.
He looked around frantically. But he was all alone.
You can do this, honey.
It was Lizzie. It couldn't be, of course, but it was. He closed his eyes. Can I? He asked.
Yes.
She said.
You have to, Jack. For the children.
Jack crawled back to his bed and lay there. Had Lizzie really spoken to him? He didn't know. Part of him knew it was impossible, but what was happening to him seemed impossible too. He closed his eyes, conjured her image in his mind, and smiled. The next night he heard the squeak of the gurney. The patient next door to him would suffer no longer. The person was in a better place. Jack had seen the minister walk down the hallway, Bible in hand. A better place. But Jack was no longer thinking about dying. For the first time since his death sentence had been pronounced, Jack was focused on living. The next night, as the clock hit midnight, Jack lifted himself off the bed and slowly walked around the room, supporting himself by putting one hand against the wall. He felt stronger, his lungs operating somewhat normally. It was as though his body was healing itself minute by minute. He heard a rumbling in his belly and realized that he was hungry. And he didn't want liquid pouring into a line. He wanted real food, food that required teeth to consume. Every so often, he would smack his arm to make sure he wasn't dreaming. At last, he convinced himself it was real. No, it wasn't just real. This is a miracle. Chapter 11. 2 weeks passed, and Jack celebrated the week of his 35th birthday by gaining 4 pounds and doing away with the oxygen altogether. Miracle or not, he still had a long way to go because his body had withered over the months. He had to rebuild his strength and put on weight. He sat up in his chair for several hours at a time. Using a walker, he regularly made his way to the bathroom all on his own. Another week passed, and 4 more pounds had appeared on his frame. Things that Jack, along with most people, had always taken for granted, represented small but significant victories in his improbable recovery. Holding a fork and using it to put solid food into his mouth. Washing his face and using a toilet instead of a bedpan. Touching his toes, breathing on his own. The hospice staff had been remarkably supportive of Jack after it was clear that he was getting better. Perhaps it was because they were weary of people leaving this place solely on the gurney with a sheet thrown over their bodies. Jack talked to his kids every chance he got, using his old cell phone. Jackie was bubbly and mostly incoherent, but Jack could sense that the older kids were wondering what was going on. Corey said, "Dad, can't you come live with us?" "We'll see, buddy. Let's just take it slow." With the help of the folks at the hospice, Jack was able to use Skype to see his kids on a laptop computer one of the medical techs brought in. Corey and Jackie were thrilled to see their dad looking better. Mickey was more subdued and cautious than her brothers, but Jack could tell she was curious and hopeful.
"You look stronger, Dad."
"I'm feeling better."
"Does this mean..."
She stopped.
"I mean, will you..."
Jack's real fear, even though he did believe he was experiencing a true miracle, was that his recovery might be temporary. He did not want to put his kids through this nightmare again, but that didn't mean he couldn't talk to them or see them. "I don't know, honey. I'm trying to figure that out. I'm doing my best."
"Well, keep doing what you're doing,"
she replied, and then she smiled at him. That one look seemed to make every muscle in Jack's body firm even more. One time, Bonnie had appeared on the computer screen after Mickey had left the room. Her approach was far more direct, as she stared at Jack sitting up in bed.
"What is going on?"
"I'm still here."
"Your hospice doctor won't talk to me. Privacy laws," he said.
"I know," Jack said, "but I can fill you in. I'm feeling better, getting stronger. How are things working out with Mickey?"
"Fine. She's settled in, but we need to address your situation."
"I am addressing it every day." And so it had gone, day after day, week after week, using Skype and the phone and answering all the kids' questions. Jack could see that more and more, even Mickey, was coming to grips with what was happening. Every time he saw her smile or heard her laugh at some funny remark he made, it seemed to strengthen him even more. It was on a cold, blustery Monday morning in February that Jack walked down the hall under his own power. He'd gained 5 more pounds. His face had filled out, and his hair was growing back. His appetite had returned with a vengeance. They had also stopped giving him pain meds because there was no more pain.
The hospice doctor sat down with him at the end of the week.
I'm not sure what's going on here, Jack, but I'm ordering up some new blood work and other tests to see what we have. I don't want you to get your hopes up, though.
Jack simply stared at him, a spoonful of soup poised near his lips. The doctor went on.
Look, if this continues, that's terrific. No one will be happier than me. Well, of course, except for you. All of my patients die, Jack, to put it bluntly, and we just try to help them pass with dignity. But your disease is a complicated one, and always a fatal one. This might just be a false remission.
Might be.
Well, without dashing your hopes, it probably is.
Have others in my condition had a remission? The doctor looked taken aback.
No, not to my knowledge.
That's all I needed to know. The doctor looked confused.
Needed to know about what?
I know I was dying, but now I'm not.
How can you be so sure?
Sometimes you just know.
Jack, I have to tell you that what's happening to you is medically impossible.
Medicine is not everything. The doctor looked him over and saw the new muscle, the fuller face, and the eyes that burned with a rigid intensity.
Why do you think this is happening to you, Jack? He finally asked.
You're a doctor. You wouldn't understand.
I'm also a human being, and I'd very much like to know.
Jack reached in his drawer and pulled out a photo. He passed it to the doctor. It was a photo of Lizzie and the kids.
Because of them, said Jack.
But I thought your wife passed away.
Jack shook his head. Doesn't matter.
What?
When you love someone, you love them forever. Chapter 12. 2 days later, Jack was in his room eating a full meal. He'd put on 3 more pounds. The doctor walked in and perched on the edge of the bed.
Okay, I officially believe in miracles. Your blood work came back negative. No trace of the disease. It's like something came along and chased it away. Never seen anything like it. There's no way to explain it medically.
Jack swallowed a mouthful of mashed potatoes and smiled. I'm glad you finally came around. He saw his kids that night on the computer. He believed he actually made Jackie understand that he was getting better. At least his son's last words had been, Daddy's boo-boo's gone. Corey had blurted out, When are you coming to see me?
I hope soon, big guy, I'll let you know. I've still got a ways to go, but I'm getting there.
Mickey's reaction surprised him, and not in a good way.
Is this some kind of trick?
She asked. Jack slowly sat up in his chair as he stared at her.
Trick?
When we left you, Dad, you were dying. That's what hospice is for. You said goodbye to all of us. You made me go live with Gramps and her.
Honey, it's no trick. I'm getting better. She suddenly dissolved into tears.
Well, then, will you be coming to take us home? Because I hate it here.
I'm doing my best, sweetie. With a little more time, I think. But Mickey hit a key, and the computer screen went black. Jack slowly sat back. He never heard the squeak of the gurney as the woman across the hall made her final journey from this place. Day turned to night, and Jack hadn't moved. No food, no liquids, no words spoken to anyone who came to see him. Finally, at around 2 a.m., he stirred. He rose from his bed and walked up and down the hall before persuading a nurse to scavenge in the kitchen for some food. He ate and watched his reflection in the window. I'm coming, Mickey. Dad's coming for you. A week later, he weighed over 160 and was walking the halls for an hour at a time. Like an infant, he was relearning how to use his arms and legs. He would flex his fingers and toes, curl and uncurl his arms, bend his legs. The nursing staff watched him carefully, unaccustomed to this sort of thing. Families of other hospice patients observed him curiously. At first, Jack was afraid they would be devastated by his progress when their loved ones still lay dying. At least he thought that, until one woman approached him. She was in her 60s and was here every day. Jack knew that her husband had terminal cancer. He'd passed by the man's door and seen the shriveled body under the sheets. He was waiting to die like everyone else here. Everyone except me. She slipped her arm through his and said,
God bless you.
He looked at her questioningly.
You give us all hope.
Jack felt slightly panicked. I don't know why this is happening to me, he said frankly, but it's an awfully long shot.
That's not what I meant. I know my husband is going to die, but you still give us all hope, honey.
Jack went back to his room and stared at himself in the mirror. He looked more like himself now. The jawline was firming, the hair fuller. He walked slowly to the window and looked outside at a landscape that was still more in the grips of winter than spring, though that season was not too far off. He'd spent several winters apart from his family while he carried a rifle for his country. Lying in his quarters outside of Baghdad or Kabul, he had closed his eyes and visualized Christmas with his family. The laughter of Mickey and Corey as they opened presents on Christmas morning. And then there was the memory of Lizzie's smile as she looked at the small gifts that Jack had bought her before he was deployed for the first time. It had been the summer, so he had gotten her sunblock, a bikini, and a book on grilling. She later sent him a photo by email of her wearing the bikini while cooking hot dogs on the hibachi, with mounds of snow behind her. That image had carried him through one hellish battle after another. His wife, her smile, wanting so badly to come back to her. That all seemed so long ago, and in some important ways, it was. He went to his nightstand and pulled out the bundle of letters. Each had a number on the envelope. He selected the envelope with the number 1 on it and slid the paper out. The letter was dated December 18th and represented the first one he'd written to Lizzie. He gazed down at the handwriting that was his, but that also wasn't, because the disease had made him so weak. Sometimes, while writing, he'd had to put down the pen because he just couldn't hold it any longer. But still, it was readable. It said what he had wanted to say. It was the accomplishment of a man who was doing this as his final act in life. Dear Lizzie, there are things I want to say to you that I just don't have the breath for anymore. That's why I've decided to write you these letters. I want you to have them after I'm gone. They're not meant to be sad, just my chance to talk to you one more time. When I was healthy, you made me happier than any person has a right to be. When I was half a world away, I knew that I was looking at the same sky you were, thinking of the same things you were, wanting to be with you, and looking forward to when I could be. You gave me 3 beautiful children, which is a greater gift than I deserved. I tell you this, though you already know it, because sometimes people don't talk about these things enough. I want you to know that if I could have stayed with you, I would have. I fought as hard as I could. I will never understand why I had to be taken from you so soon, but I have accepted it. Yet I want you to know that there is nothing more important to me than you. I loved you from the moment I saw you, and the happiest day of my life was when you agreed to share your life with mine. I promised that I would always be there for you. And my love for you is so strong that even though I won't be there physically, I will be there in every other way. I will watch over you. I will be there if you need to talk. I will never stop loving you. Not even death is powerful enough to overcome my feelings for you. My love for you, Lizzie, is stronger than anything. Love, Jack. He put the letter back in the envelope and replaced the packet in the drawer. He slipped the photo from the pocket of his robe and looked at it. From the depths of the color print, his family smiled back at him. He thought of all the others in this place who would never leave it alive. He had been spared. Why me? Jack had no ready answer, but he did know one thing. He was not going to waste a second chance at living. Chapter 13. A few days later, Jack Armstrong was discharged from hospice and sent to a rehab facility. He rode over in a shuttle van. The driver was an older guy with a soft felt cap and a trim white beard. Jack was his only passenger. As they drove along, Jack stared out in childlike wonder at things he never thought he would experience again. Seeing a bird in flight, a mailman delivering letters and packages, a kid running for the school bus. He promised himself he would never again take anything for granted. As they pulled up in front of the rehab building, the man said, "Never brought anybody from that place to this place." "I guess not," said Jack. He held his small duffel. Inside were a few clothes, a pair of tennis shoes, and the letters he'd written to Lizzie. When he got to his room, he looked around at the simple furnishings and single window that had a view of the interior outdoor courtyard, which was covered in snow. Jack sat on the bed after putting his few belongings away. He looked up when a familiar person walked into the room. "Sammy, what are you doing here?" Sammy Duvall was dressed in gray sweats and had on a checkered bandana. "Why the hell do you think I'm here?" "To get your sorry butt in shape. Look at you. You've obviously been dogging it. And they told me you were getting better. You look like crap." "I don't understand. You didn't come by the hospice, and I left you phone messages." The mirth left Sammy's eyes, and he sat down next to Jack on the bed. "I let you down." "What are you talking about? You've done everything for me." "No, I haven't. I told you at the cemetery that I'd always be there for you, but I wasn't." He paused. Jack had never seen Sammy nervous before. That emotion just never squared with a man like him. Nothing rattles Sammy Duvall. Sammy's voice trembled as he said, "I should have come to visit you, but seeing you in that place, just waiting to..." Jack put a hand on the older man's shoulder. "It's okay, Sammy. I understand." Sammy wiped his eyes and said, "Anyway, I'm here now, and you're probably gonna wish I wasn't." "Why?" "I'm your drill instructor."
"What?"
"Worked a deal with the folks here."
"How'd you do that?"
"Told them you were a special case, and you need special treatment. And if you're okay with it, so are they."
"I'm definitely okay with it. That was one reason I called you. To have you help me get back in shape."
"Famous last words, boy. Because I'm gonna kick your butt."
The weeks went by swiftly, and with pain. Much pain. The sweat streaming off him during one particularly arduous workout, Jack told Sammy, "I can't do one more damn push-up. I can't."
"Can't or won't, because that's all the difference in the world, son."
Jack did one more push-up, and then another, and then a third, until he could no longer feel his arms. Jack had gone on to pump thousands of pounds of weights, run on the treadmill until he couldn't stand the stink of his own sweat, perform more push-ups until his arms nearly fell off, jump rope until his knees failed. He cursed at Sammy, who laughed at him and goaded him into doing more and more.
"You call yourself an Army Ranger? Sam Jr. can work harder than you, and he's a big fat baby."
And Sammy didn't just instruct. He got down on the floor and did the exercises with Jack.
"If an old man like me can do this, you sure as hell can,"
was his usual taunt. On and on it went. Sammy screaming in his face and Jack gnashing his teeth, furrowing his brow, and doing one more pull-up, one more push-up, one more mile on the treadmill, one more set of curls, 100 more pounds on the squat bar. But the thing was, Jack was growing stronger with every rep. He talked to his kids every day. They knew he was in rehab. They knew he was getting stronger. On one joint Skype session, Jack showed Corey and Jackie his muscles. "You're ripped, Dad," said Corey.
"Whipped," crowed Jackie.
Later that night, he saw Mickey. She hadn't agreed to do a Skype session with him in a while, but repeated phone calls from him, and finally Sammy, had convinced her.
"You look great, Dad,"
she said slowly.
"You really do."
"You look thin," he replied.
"Yeah, well, Grandma is watching her weight, which means we all eat like birds."
"Cheeseburgers on me."
"When?"
"Sooner than you think, sweetie. I know I probably should have come out to see you before now, and I miss you more than anything, but I want to do this right. When I was in the Army and we'd go on patrol, I always analyzed everything that might come up. Some of the other guys like to wing it, just turn on the fly. And sometimes in combat you have to do that. But being prepared for everything because you've done your homework is the best way to survive, Mickey. I hope you understand. I want to do this right for all of you."
"I get it, Dad,"
she added playfully.
"And Skype will get you ready for when I go to college and you really miss me."
Finally, the day came on a surprisingly warm spring morning. Jack's bag was packed, and he was sitting on his bed when Sammy came into the room. "It's time."
"I know it is," said Sammy.
"I couldn't have done this without you."
"Sure you could. But it wouldn't have been nearly as much fun."
While his discharge papers were being finalized, Jack sat in a chair outside the rehab office. The months had been a blur. He drew a long, measured breath, trying to collect his thoughts. He looked out the window, where winter had passed and spring had arrived. Crocuses were pushing through the earth, and trees were starting to bud out. "The world is waking up from a long winter's nap, and so am I." He opened his duffel and pulled out an envelope with the number 2 on it. He slid out the letter. "Dear Lizzie, Christmas will be here in 5 days, and I promise that I will make it. I've never broken a promise to you, and I never will. It's hard to say goodbye, but sometimes you have to do things you don't want to. Jackie came to see me a little while ago, and we talked. Well, he talked in Jackie language, and I listened. I like to listen to him because I know one day, very soon, I won't be able to. He's growing up so fast, and I know he probably won't remember his dad. But I know I will live on in your memories. Tell him his dad loved him and wanted the best for him. And I wish I could have thrown the football to him and watched him play baseball. I know he will have a great life. Corey is a special little boy. He has your sensitivity, your compassion. I know what's happening to me is probably affecting him the most of all the kids. He came and got into bed with me last night. He asked me if it hurt very much. I told him it didn't. He told me to say hello to God when I saw him, and I promised that I would. And Mickey." At this point, Jack's hand trembled a bit. He remembered stopping at this point, too, as he was writing the letter. There was an old teardrop that had made the ink blotch. He started to read again. "Mickey is the most complicated of all. Not a little girl anymore, but not yet an adult either. She is a good kid, though I know you've had your moments with her. She is smart and caring, and she loves her brothers. She loves you, though she sometimes doesn't like to show it. My greatest regret with my daughter is letting her grow away from me. It was my fault, not hers. I see that clearly now. I only wish I had seen it that clearly while I still had a chance to do something about it. After I'm gone, please tell her the first time I ever saw her, when I got back from Afghanistan and was still in uniform, there was no prouder father who ever lived. Looking down at her tiny face, I felt the purest joy a human could possibly feel. And I wanted to protect her and never let anything bad ever happen to her. Life doesn't work that way, of course. But tell her that her dad was her biggest fan, and that whatever she does in life, I will always be her biggest fan. Love, Jack. Chapter 14. After being discharged, Jack rode with Sammy to his house. Along the way, he asked his friend to pass by his old home. Jack was surprised to see his pickup truck in the carport. Sammy explained, "Went with the house sale, so I heard. Bonnie and the realtor handled all that. Is that my tool bin in the back?" "Yep, guess that went too. All happened pretty fast." He eyed Jack. "Knew you'd beat that damn thing. Still got the tickets to Disney World?"
"Yeah,"
said Jack, staring glumly out the window. 5 of them. Later, Jack drove to his bank. They had kept the account open to pay for expenses. It had a few $1,000s left in it. That was a starting point. He had his wallet, and his credit cards were still valid. Driver's license was still good. Contractor's license intact. He drove to his old house and offered the owner $800 on the spot for the truck and tools. After some negotiation back and forth, he got them for $850, the owner apparently glad to get the heap out of his driveway. Jack raced to the bank and got a cashier's check. The title was signed over, and he drove off in his old ride the same day. He called the kids and told them he was out of rehab and getting a place for them all to live in. He next talked to Bonnie and explained things to her.
"That's wonderful, Jack,"
she'd said. But her words rang hollow. She asked him what his next step would be. "Like I said, getting my family back. I'll be coming out there really soon."
"Do you think that's wise?"
"Bonnie, I'm their father. They belong with me." That night, he treated Sammy to dinner. While Sammy had a medium-rare burger, fries, and black coffee, Jack made 3 trips to the salad bar before settling down to devour his heaping plate of surf and turf.
"So what's the plan, Chief?"
"Get my kids back, pronto. But I need a place for us to stay."
"You're welcome to stay at my place, long as you want."
Sammy's place had 1 bedroom and a bathroom attached to the back, with only an outsized entrance. Sammy's massive Harley was parked in what he referred to as the parlor. Besides that, his puppy, Sam Jr., had the bulk of a Honda. "That's fine for me, but with 3 kids, I'll need something a little bigger." Late that night, he slowly pulled his truck down the narrow roads of the cemetery. He'd been here only once, on a bitterly cold day, the ground flash-wrapped in ice and snow. And yet even though he'd been sick, he'd memorized every detail of the place. He could never forget where his wife was buried any more than he could ever fail to recall his own name. He walked between the plots until he reached hers, represented by a simple bronze plate in the grass. He knelt down, brushed a couple of dead leaves off it. There was a skinny metal vase bolted to the plate where one could put flowers. There were roses in there, but they were brown. Jack cleaned them all out and placed in the vase a bunch of fresh flowers he brought with him. He sat down on his haunches and read the writing on the plate. "Elizabeth Lizzie Armstrong, loving wife, mother, and daughter. You will always be missed. You will always be loved." He traced the letters with his fingers, even as his eyes filled with tears. "I'm going to get the kids, Lizzie. I'm going to bring them home, and we're going to be a family again." He choked back a sob and tried to ignore the dull pain in his chest. "I wish you could be here with me, Lizzie. More than anything, I wish that. But you were there for me in the hospital when I needed you. And I promise I will take good care of the children. I will make them proud, and I will raise them right, just like you did." The words finally failed him, and he lay down on the soft grass and wept. He finally became so exhausted, he fell asleep. When he woke, he didn't know where he was for a few seconds, before he looked over and saw the grave. The dawn was breaking, the air chilly. As he looked overhead, he could see flocks of birds arriving for the start of spring. Jack's clothes were damp from the dew. He coughed to clear his throat. His eyes and face were raw. In the distance, he could hear the sounds of early morning traffic on the roads that fronted the cemetery. He walked silently back to his truck and drove off without the one person he needed more than anyone else. Chapter 15. One day later, Jack found it, a house owned by an elderly couple who had moved to an assisted living facility. They couldn't sell their home because it needed a lot of repairs, and with dozens of homes in default on their street, it was difficult to sell anyway. Jack called the realtor and offered his labor for free to fix up the place in exchange for staying there at no cost. Since the couple wasn't making any money off the house anyway, they quickly agreed. It wasn't perfect, but he didn't need perfect. He just needed his kids under the same roof as him. Jack moved his few possessions in the next day, after signing a one-page agreement. He made some quick cosmetic changes and bought some second-hand furniture. Now it was time. Using his credit card, he booked his plane tickets, packed his bag, and left for the airport. He went to collect Mickey first, because he knew if he went to the sisters' homes first, they would be on the phone to their mother before he'd even left their driveways. He landed in Phoenix, rented a car, and drove to Tempe. He reached Fred and Bonnie's house, but then drove past it. He parked a little down from the house and waited. An hour later, a car pulled into the driveway, and Fred and Mickey got out. She was carrying her school bag. His heart ached when he saw her. She'd grown even taller, Jack noted, and her face had changed, too. She was wearing a school uniform, white polo shirt and checked skirt. Her hair was in a ponytail and had nary a strand of pink or purple in it. She looked utterly miserable. They went into the house. Jack parked in their driveway, took a deep breath, climbed out of the car, and walked up to the door.
Dad?
Mickey stared at him open-mouthed. When he held out his arms for a hug, she tentatively reached out to him. He stroked her hair and kissed the top of her head.
Dad, is it really you?
It's me, sweetie. It's really me. Bonnie and Fred came around the corner, saw him, and stopped. Jack? Said Fred. My God! Bonnie just stood there, disbelief on her features. Jack moved into the house with Mickey. He held out his hand and Fred shook it. He looked at Bonnie. She still seemed in a daze.
My God,
she said, echoing her husband's words.
It's true. It's really true. Even with all the phone calls and seeing you on that computer, it's not the same. What is all the commotion?
Cecilia came into the room, skimming along on her walker, her oxygen line trailing behind her. When she saw Jack, she didn't freeze like Fred and Bonnie had done. She cackled.
I knew it.
She came forward as fast as she could and gave him a prolonged squeeze.
Yeah, I knew it, Jack, honey.
She said again, staring up at him and blinking back tears of joy. They all sat at the kitchen table sipping glasses of iced tea. Jack eyed Bonnie. Doc's gave me a clean bill of health. Bonnie just kept shaking her head, but Fred clapped him on the shoulder. Jack, we're so happy for you, son. Later, when they were alone, Bonnie asked,
How long will you be staying?
From here, I'm heading to L.A. and then on to Portland.
To see the kids?
No, to take them back with me, Bonnie. I've already told Mickey to start packing her things.
Bet the school year will be done in less than 2 months.
She can go to school in Cleveland as easily as she can here.
But the house was sold.
I'm renting another one.
How will you support them?
I've started my business back up.
Okay, but who will watch them when you're working?
And they're old enough now to come home and be okay by themselves for a few hours. Jackie will be in extended daycare. And if unexpected things come up, we'll deal with them, just like every other family does. Bonnie pursed her lips.
Michelle has settled into her new life here.
Jack said nothing about how miserable the girl had been here. He simply said, I don't think she'll mind.
You could have called before you came.
Yeah, I could have, and maybe I should have. But I don't see what harm it did.
What harm? You just expect us to give her back to you with no notice, no preparation? After all we've done.
I've been in constant contact over the last few months. I kept you updated on my progress. Hell, you've seen me on the computer getting better, and I told you I would be coming to take the kids back. Soon. So this shouldn't come as a shock to you, and it's not like you're never going to see them again. He paused and his tone changed. Even though you did leave me by myself.
You said it was all right. You told us to do it. And we thought you were dying.
Come on, Bonnie, what else could I tell you under the circumstances? But for the record, dying alone is a real bitch. As soon as Jack finished speaking, he regretted it. Bonnie stood, her face red with anger.
Don't you dare talk to me about dying alone. My Lizzie is lying dead and buried. There was no one with her at the end. No one. Certainly not you.
Jack eyed her. Why don't you just say it, Bonnie? Because I know you want to.
You should be dead, not her.
Bonnie seemed stunned by her own words.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
Her face flushed.
I'm very sorry.
I would give my life to have Lizzie back, but I can't. I've got 3 kids who need me. Nothing takes priority over that. I hope you can understand.
What I understand is that you're taking your children from a safe, healthy environment into something totally unknown.
I'm their father, said Jack heatedly.
You're a single parent. Lizzie isn't here to take care of the kids.
I can take care of them.
Can you? Because I don't think you have any idea what's in store for you.
Jack started to say something but stopped. Could she be right? Chapter 16.
Mr. Armstrong?
Jack stared down from the ladder he was standing on while repairing some siding on a job site. The sun was high overhead, the air warm, and the sweat on his skin thick. He had on a white tank top, dirty dark blue cargo shorts, white crew socks, and worn steel-toed work boots. The woman down below was pretty, with light brown curly hair cut short, and she wore a pair of black slacks and a white blouse. Her heels were sunk in the wet grass. What can I do for you, ma'am?
I'm Janice Kaplan. I'm a newspaper reporter. I'd like to talk to you.
Jack clambered down the ladder and rubbed his hands off on the back of his shorts. Talk to me about what?
Being the miracle man.
Jack squinted at her. Come again?
You are the Jack Armstrong who was diagnosed with a terminal illness?
Well, yeah, I was.
You don't look terminal anymore.
I'm not. I got better.
So, a miracle. At least, that's what the doctor I talked to said.
Jack looked annoyed. You talked to my doctor? I thought that was private.
Actually, he's a friend of mine. He mentioned your case in passing. It was all very positive. I became interested, did a little digging, and here I am.
Here for what? Jack said, puzzled.
To do a story on you. People with death sentences rarely get a second chance. I'd like to talk to you about the experience, and I know my readers would want to know.
Jack and the kids have been back for nearly 4 weeks now. With parenting and financial support resting solely on his shoulders, Jack barely had time to eat or sleep. Bonnie had been right in her prediction. He didn't have any idea what was in store for him. Mickey had really stepped up and taken the laboring oar, with the cooking and cleaning, the shopping, and looking after the boys. He had never had greater appreciation for Lizzie. She'd done it all, from school to meals to laundry to shopping to keeping the house clean. Jack had worked hard, but he realized now that he hadn't come close to working as hard as his wife had, because she did all that and worked full-time too. At midnight, he lay in his bed, numb and exhausted, and humbled by the knowledge that Lizzie would have still been going strong. A story? Jack shook his head as he dug a hole in the mulch bed with the toe of his boot. Look, it's really not that special.
Don't be modest. And I also understand that you turned your life around, built your business back, got a house, and went to retrieve your children, who'd been placed with family after your wife tragically died.
She added.
I was very sorry to hear about that. On Christmas Eve, too, of all days.
Jack's annoyance turned to anger. You didn't learn all that from my doctor. That really is an invasion of privacy.
Please don't be upset, Mr. Armstrong. I'm a reporter. It's my job to find out these things. And I'm probably not explaining myself very well.
She drew a deep breath while Jack stared at her, his hands clenching into fists with his anxiety.
It's strictly a feel-good piece. One man's triumph against the odds. A family reunited. These are hard times for folks, especially around here. All we hear is bad news, war, crime, people losing their jobs and their homes. I write about that stuff all the time, and while it is news, it's also very, very depressing. But this is different. This is a great story that will make people smile. That's all I'm shooting for, to make people feel good for once.
His anger quickly disappearing, Jack looked around while he considered her request. He saw Sammy up on another ladder watching him intently. He waved to show him things were okay. Jack turned back to the woman. So, what exactly do I have to do?
Just sit down with me and tell your story.